Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
This is the first part of a two-part process on the Emergency Livestock Relief Program.
Farm Service Agency Deputy Administrator Scott Marlowe on ELRP.
One of our directives was to get this rolling as quickly as we can to use existing documentation and existing paperwork that farmers have already done. The way that this program is going to work is that it will be based on their livestock forage disaster program coverage from back in 2021. We expect for those payments to begin to drop as early as next week. So this will move very quickly. There will be some documentation that farmers will need to bring in over time after the payment rolls. But it will be quite seamless for them. And we're really working hard on these to make sure that the grower can get it with as little difficulty or as little work on their part as possible.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
I want to say again how important this hearing is and all of the ones that we've had as we review our present 2018 Farm Bill and as we prepare for the 2023.
Chairman of the House Ag Committee from Georgia, David Scott.
We have these hearings so we on this committee can hear from our participants so we can find out what's working and what's not working as we prepare our 2023 Farm Bill. And today's hearing will cover the various Farm Bill provisions that cover energy production and energy efficiency, and I'm looking forward to the discussion on how renewable energy production can provide new revenue streams for our agriculture producers and our rural economies, and also how energy efficiencies can help lower input costs.
The ranking member from Pennsylvania, G.T. Thompson.
I'm always excited to talk about energy. Pennsylvania's 15th congressional district is really the original energy district, and I don't see any of my friends from Texas in here, so they'll take exception to that later. But it really is. We're steeped in a diverse history of energy production. Pennsylvania 15 coal fueled the Industrial Revolution, provided the arsenal of democracy to be able to win World War I and World War II. We're home to the nation's first ever commercial oil well, the Commonwealth's only ethanol plant, and the oldest continuing operating oil refinery in the United States. More recently, America has become the world's largest producer and exporter of natural gas, while at the same time reducing U.S. emissions. The Appalachian Basin alone, which includes the Marcellus and the Utica Shale, represents the third largest producing region in the world, behind Russia and the rest of the United States. And we're incredibly proud of our role in powering not only the Commonwealth's economy, but also the nation, our allies abroad, and the globe.
Soshitora Small, a former member of the committee, is now Undersecretary for USDA's Rural Development.
As we discuss this topic, it's essential to recognize that we're talking about people and communities in transition. It's not lost on me that I'm speaking to you today as a New Mexican whose public education was funded by the energy production that continues to fuel our state. I'm honored to know parents who put their kids through college from the money they earned working in the Permian Basin, and continue to be inspired by the hard work and innovation that occurs across New Mexico's energy sector. In this room today, we can talk about transition, but across rural America, people are living it. And in many places, they're driving it. A young person working in energy today could be working in solar or wind while their grandparents were experts in fossil fuels, because this transition has been happening for at least a decade. Like all transitions, this one has bumps. There's disagreement and there's pain. There's also consensus and innovation and increased efficiency and job creation. And I want to talk about all of these things. In particular, I hope to highlight what rural co-ops are doing in this space. But before we dive into that, I hope we can begin with an agreement that the hard work and ingenuity that came out of rural America before renewables should be honored and valued. It powered this country for over a century, contributed significantly to American prosperity as a whole, and continues to be an important part of America's energy portfolio today. I'm grateful for that contribution, and I know all of you are as well.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
My home state of Idaho is proof positive of that proposition.
Hearing last week for the Senate Finance Committee on Trade, Mike Crapo, senator from Idaho.
In 2019, international trade supported over 200,000 jobs in Idaho, or almost 20% of the state's employment. Trade liberalization also saves the average Idaho family of four more than $10,000 per year. The problem here is that President Biden's recognition of trade's overall importance is not matched with an agenda that contains the requisite ambition to succeed. There is not a single free trade agreement under consideration in this agenda. Free trade agreements open opportunities. We have seen it over and over, and the past really is prologue. Idaho's dairy exports to Korea increased by more than 250% since our free trade agreement entered into force in 2012. But in lieu of trade agreements, this administration is proposing dialogues and frameworks, including the new Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, or IPEF. IPEF may be a positive first step to engagement in Asia, but it is no substitute for comprehensive trade agreements. The Center for Strategic and International Studies will soon release its upcoming analysis on IPEF, based on conversations with over a dozen governments in the Indo-Pacific. 2 points from its analysis are instructive. First, U.S. engagement is welcome in the Indo-Pacific. One diplomat stressed in particular that his country wants the United States to lay out an affirmative economic strategy that complements its security presence in the region. Second, our partners see the IPEF as a proposal with many U.S. asks, few U.S. offers, and a variety of credible regional alternatives to the framework that could provide more tangible benefits. If the U.S. is to meet and exceed China's challenge, then the U.S. must make stronger commitments than China. Regrettably, if the administration's negotiating ambitions are low, its consultations with Congress on the few negotiations actually taking place is even lower. At last year's trade agenda hearing, Ambassador Tai, you stated that you would brief this committee before and after each negotiating session with respect to a waiver of the WTO TRIPS agreement. That hasn't happened. USTR recently issued a press release confirming that it had reached a compromise outcome on the TRIPS waiver in discussions with South Africa, India, and the European Union. USTR refuses to share the text of that outcome with this committee. While members may have different views on the merits of this waiver, every member here should agree with me that the administration cannot withhold documents concerning U.S. rights under a congressionally approved trade agreement. We need to see the document, and we need to ask questions, because that is what respect for the Constitution requires.
He was addressing the U.S. Trade Representative, Ambassador Catherine Tai.
USTR will lead efforts to craft a trade arrangement with our Indo-Pacific partners that includes high-standard labor commitments, environmental sustainability, the digital economy, sustainable food systems and science-based agricultural regulation, good regulatory practices, and trade facilitation. On the multilateral front, the Biden administration has continued efforts to make the WTO a force for good. We are working towards an intellectual property outcome to help end the pandemic. We will continue to engage with WTO members to get safe and effective vaccines to as many people as possible, and we are committed to bringing reform to the organization.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
We've got logistical problems. People talk about supply chain problems and, different types of things. And supply chain problems are hitting the cotton market.
Donna Hughes is a broker with StoneX.
There's problems with shipments. There's problems with procuring cotton. I know a couple of months earlier, I've heard of cotton producers that were booking, this year's cotton ahead. And so now, over the past couple of weeks, we heard not too much of that is going on. And pretty much all that would be booked for this year is probably done at this point. But the demand is very good. And so, when it just comes down to supply and demand, I mean, we're tight on the physical side of it. And there's good demand, a lot of problems getting things around the world. And a big factor in all of this is is investment money. We've had a tremendous amount of investment money poured into commodities, and so when you see those big, you know, big market moves in either direction, you've either got you know, investment money coming in or coming out of the markets. And generally, if you look at the stock markets at the same time, we could see, you know, stock markets reacting in a different direction. And so you know, it all comes down to money flow, and you know, that's been a large part of it.
And we're watching a lot of outside money come into the market. What role do speculators play?
It's very important for liquidity and for opportunity. You know, producers, you know, we've had some producers that have booked cotton, and seeing the prices going higher, you know, they may have opted to purchase call options, or maybe re-own it on the board with futures. This way, you know, as long as the money comes in, the prices go higher, even though you have sold your cotton already, there's a way to capture the prices as they go higher. So that's one way of doing it. If you haven't sold cotton and you've been sitting on it, good for you, because at these prices, you're probably a lot better off than you would have been a couple months ago had you booked that cash contract. So it does make it difficult for the end users, because as they're buying, you know, they're going short the market, and as prices go higher, that really tilts towards their margin and what they're able to do with that. So that side of the equation is a little bit different, but all in all, it's good opportunity, creates a lot of liquidity, and it's kind of any day at any time, it's hold on to your hat.
All the more reason to have a good marketing plan, starting with the Master Marketer Program, Dr. Mark Welch.
There is no more comprehensive risk management program in the country for agricultural producers than Master Marketer. And when we say comprehensive, many times we focus on, you know, hedging and contracting strategies, and we do spend a lot of time on price risk management, but we talk about crop insurance and production risk. We talk about legal risk. We talk about working with a lender. We talk about human risk, and whether that's with employees and all the other challenges around making our farms and ranches operate to the most efficient grade possible. And we spend so much time together that not only with a range of instructors, you build that relationship within the class. And so the things we learn from each other is just as important as what we hand out in the notebooks every week. And so it's absolutely a life-changing educational program that touches on those five or six key areas of risk running a farm and ranch. They're just critical, especially in environments like we have now, but really any time, just the challenge of making a living and running a family farming business.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The Ag Economy Barometer declined to a reading of 113 this month, down from 125 last month. That's the lowest reading for the barometer since May of 2020.
Dr. Jim Mentert is director of the Center for Commercial Agriculture at Purdue University, breaking down the latest numbers from the March Purdue CME Group Ag Economy Barometer.
The index of current conditions and the index of future expectations both declined this month. The index of current conditions declined from a reading of 132 last month to a reading of 113 this month, and the index of future expectations fell from 122 to 113. The Farm Financial Performance Index rose slightly this month to a reading of 87 compared to last month's reading of 83, but remains well below where it was at the end of last year when it was a reading of 113. Producers continue to expect 2022 to be a much worse year than 2021. The Farm Capital Investment Index declined 6 points this month to a reading of 36. That's down from 42 last month, and that's a new all-time low for that Farm Capital Investment Index. Supply chain issues continue to be a problem. Over 40% of producers in this month's survey say their purchase plans have been impacted by low farm machinery inventory levels. Once again this month, we asked producers what their biggest concerns are for their farming operation in the upcoming year. 41% of producers in this month's survey said high input prices were their number one concern, and that was followed by availability of inputs at 19%, as well as low crop or livestock prices, also at 19%. The March survey was the first time we conducted a survey following the invasion of Ukraine. In this month's survey, we asked producers what they expected to be the biggest change on U.S. agriculture as a result of the war. 63% said input prices would be the most likely factor affected, followed by crop prices at 33%. Producers were somewhat less optimistic about farmland values in this month's survey than they were in February. The long-term farmland value expectation index declined to a reading of 146 compared to 154 last month. And when you look at it from a longer-term perspective, it's starting to look like farmers' expectations for rising farmland values actually peaked in the fall, although the index readings remain relatively strong compared to history.
But there is optimism, right now at least, in the hog market. Dr. Jason Franken is with Western Illinois University.
There is the possibility of profitable hog prices in 2022 if feed costs don't rise too high. The forecast presented here is for the national weighted average net price on a carcass basis for all transactions for producer-sold barrows and gilts, including negotiated and contract prices. This net price should be more reflective of what producers actually receive on average and normally runs at a premium of more than $2 a hundredweight over the base price on average. From December to February, this net price averaged $82.12 a hundredweight compared to $71.37 a hundredweight for the corresponding net prices for negotiated or spot transactions. In general, hog prices tend to be higher in the second and third quarters with lower prices in the first and fourth quarters, and this forecast is consistent with that pattern. This price averaged $90.24 a hundredweight for the first quarter of 2022, but has risen notably in the later part of March. Accordingly, second and third quarter prices are forecast to average about $104.96 a hundredweight and $104.64 a hundredweight, respectively, with prices dropping to $91.04 a hundredweight in the fourth quarter of 2022 and $90.67 a hundredweight in the first quarter of 2023. These projections are consistent with the strong demand and lower supply observed currently, the effects of which may weaken somewhat later in the period if producers start to ramp up production. If hog supply turns out to be greater than anticipated or if demand falters, then, of course, lower prices may be realized.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
We have renewed our engagement with partners and allies and are developing innovative arrangements that strengthen our resilience and address the China challenge.
U.S. Trade Representative Ambassador Catherine Tai.
For example, the global arrangement we are negotiating with the EU will be the world's first sectoral arrangement on steel and aluminum trade to tackle both emissions and non-market excess capacity. Beyond this cooperation, we have deepened our engagement with key trading partners through other avenues. We launched the U.S.-EU Trade and Technology Council to promote shared economic growth. We relaunched the United States-India Trade Policy Forum to enhance our bilateral relationship. And we hosted the first dialogue on the future of Atlantic trade in Baltimore last week with the United Kingdom. We will meet again in Scotland next month to consider what concrete, economically meaningful steps we can take to deepen our trade relationship.
Another area of concern is the Indo-Pacific framework. Mike Crapo is a senator from Idaho.
With regard to the IPIF, the administration is very clear that IPIF will not include market access initiatives. Given that the administration wants to raise our trading partners' labor and environmental standards through IPIF, with which I don't disagree, why take the carrot of market access off the table?
So I appreciate this opportunity to talk a little bit more about the approach that we are contemplating and consulting with all of you on with respect to the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework. It is true that market access, strictly speaking as a trade terminology, is not on the table at this time in the framework. But I want to distinguish between what we mean by market access in trade vocabulary versus market access in ordinary English. Market access, as we talk about it in trade discussions and negotiations, typically means tariff liberalization. And that is true. We are not starting these conversations with tariff liberalization, in large part because our traditional trade models and traditional FTAs have led us to a place where we are facing a considerable backlash that we are listening to from our own people about concerns regarding the offshoring and outsourcing of American jobs and opportunities through these types of arrangements. That does not mean, however, that we are not bringing an economic engagement to this region that does not have economically meaningful outcomes. So in the sense of market access in ordinary English, which is to enhance our access to each other's markets, that is very much a part of what we are doing.
In terms of the high labor and environment standards, I really want to thank you for affirming your commitment to the standards in U.S. Trade policy practice, because that is exactly the kind of practice that we want to bring to our trading partners in order to counteract those forces that have tended to bleed out our industries to other regions. We would like to use trade to raise standards around the world, to raise standards to the standards that we have here so that we can all enjoy the kinds of lives and opportunities that we would like.
Well, I understand, and as I said, I agree with that, but I define market access as free trade agreements. And I just don't see why we cannot engage and develop. And we've got nations in the Indo-Pacific who are crying out for free trade negotiations with us so that they can strengthen their relationship to us economically rather than being tied to China. And so I just want to state that I believe that we need to engage on free trade negotiations in terms of market access and not define market access as some kind of a framework or something else.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Beef and hog producers in seven states could have a new packing plan. Todd Gleason reports.
Brent Clark told me and those gathered at the Dixon Springs research facilities that belong to the U of I that he and his partners had been working on its development since before the pandemic.
We started in about March of 2020. Discussing the need in the marketplace and the region for meat processing, protein processing. And the pandemic set in soon thereafter, and it sort of highlighted the need for processing, more processing in our area. And so that was kind of the starting point.
How did you highlight it? What do you mean?
Well, when you're a producer, there were no slots, no time availabilities to have your animals processed at local processors because we're in a part of the state, we're in a region of the country that is very limited on the amount of processing that is available for both cattle and hogs. And so when the pandemic hit, we were already tight in those processing plants, and then it was like people panicked and just filled them up. And we are at a point now, even today, that it takes still about a year to have something, a year out to get an appointment to get something processed.
We're in deep southern Illinois. How many states do you expect to serve this plant?
I think it's going to be about seven states will come with product, livestock to our plant. Illinois, Indiana, Kentucky, Tennessee, Mississippi, Arkansas, and Missouri.
What will be the processing capacity of the plant?
We're going to start out with our first line, and it'll handle 2,800 beef a month and 5,600 hogs a month. That's the first line. The second line basically doubles that capacity, and we'll turn that on once we get rolling.
Why were you at Dixon Springs tonight?
Well, Dixon Springs is like home plate for us. I mean, it's the Southern Illinois local producers, and that's where we're at. We're located in Williamson County, which is in deep Southern Illinois. And this would be home plate to start out with these producers getting the first crack at this opportunity.
Again, that was Brent Clark. He's one of the owners of the proposed Saline River Farms processing plant that would be located in Creel Springs, Illinois. That's in the deep southern part of the state. Jeff Beasley is a cattle producer actually from Creel Springs, and he was at the meeting on Wednesday evening. He's also a past president of the Illinois Beef Association. He's not completely convinced this packing plant can compete. I asked him why.
I've sold enough cattle over the years, followed the industry long enough, that I know that the four big packers, plus all the small, medium-sized packers, they're competing for X number of cattle. So these guys are just going to step into that fray, and they're not going to just be able to go out and cherry-pick the cattle they want. They're going to have to get competitive, and my question was, how are you going to be able to match the Tysons, the JBS, et cetera, to buy those cattle and procure those cattle that you need? So I just thought that was a valid question to ask those guys if that's something they've really thought about.
We had that question tonight, and it was an interesting moment because I stepped back to really think about the question when it was asked. And my initial reaction is, well, we're going to be here, we're close by. But you know what it really comes down to is we have to deliver as a company as well.
That's Jeff Diedrich. He's one of the four partners in the proposed Saline River Farms packing plant facility.
Yes, proximity is going to be extremely important, but the quality of product that we bring to the table will be very important.
They say beef cattle and hog producers in a 7-state area should expect it to open about 18 months after construction begins. That has yet to be scheduled. I'm Todd Gleason.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
The latest USDA agricultural prices report reflects producers overall receiving more price-wise for their commodities in February, particularly in the crop production index. Producers as a whole earned almost 7.5% more in prices for their commodities compared to January, with crop producers seeing a month-over-month increase in prices received at 9.3%. Much of that increase was driven by rises in food and feed grain and oilseed crop prices, with corn and soybean growers earning over 9.5% and 11% more price-wise, respectively. This offset lower prices received for vegetable, fruit, and tree nut growers. The livestock price index for February rose 1.3% from the prior month. A 4.6% increase in prices received by livestock growers and over 2% price increase month over month for dairy producers offset an almost 4% decrease in the prices received by poultry and egg farmers for their commodities. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.